We're exploring what psychology says about TV binge watching. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being with us. Friends and The Office are two of Netflix's most watched shows. Friends has been off the air for over 15 years, but the NBC sitcom still holds a special place in the hearts of many fans, like this moment with the character Joey.
Where is the waitress? I'm starving. It's a buffet, man.
Here's where I win all my money back.
Netflix recently announced it'll no longer stream the show after its contract expires. So some fans have taken to binge watching the entire series before it leaves Netflix for good. And so we want to know, what does binge watching do to our brains? Do you binge watch shows or entire seasons? What are your favorites? Do you re-watch shows or explore new ones? We're at 800-642-1234. Ben Rader is a clinical psychologist in Milwaukee and the public education coordinator for the Wisconsin Psychological Association. And he joins us from our Milwaukee studios. Ben, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hey, great. Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
So when did binge watching come onto our radar? Well, you know, when did we start doing this?
Well, I think it's something that we can really think now how we're consuming television in a much different way because of Netflix and so forth. I mean, it's right there at our fingertips, isn't it? You can just watch one more episode, and after all, it's only 20 minutes without the question, without the commercial. So it's something that's maybe a phenomenon now. It's just because of how we are able to access whatever we want whenever we want it.
Consumption just becomes so easy when one episode starts right after the last one finishes. What happens in our brains when we watch shows for long periods of time?
Well, you know, certainly the maybe the amount of time is relative, but the more you kind of enter into a monotonous routine, and particularly when you're watching any screen time, the impact on the brain can reset our sleep-wake cycle. It can certainly impact upon our ability to kind of focus and attend to things outside of that. And it doesn't necessarily bode very well for productivity in our lives outside of the series or program whatever we're watching.
What might it do to our relationships?
Well, certainly it depends on circumstance, too. Many of us find that binge watching is something we do with other people. So, you know, if you may be at home and you're there with individuals, and there may be some positive benefits where you're just able to steal another 20 minutes or whatever it is with one another and to kind of enjoy something together. But if you're kind of watching more in an isolative manner, it almost pulls you further away from those around us and keeps you kind of locked into the spell cast on us by that flashing screen.
We're talking about what happens when we binge watch TV. Clinical psychologist Ben Rader is with us. You can join in. Have you noticed that watching too much TV has impacted your health or the health of someone you know? What changes have you seen? Has binge watching shows impacted your social life, perhaps your personal relationships? Join in with your experiences, your questions, 800-642-1234. So, Ben, a psychologist in the UK recently said that watching certain shows can actually help with coping with anxiety. And he gave the example of Friends, when you often, you know, get to see relationship issues get resolved within the course of an episode. Can watching TV at all be good for us?
Yeah, I really particularly like that that finding the research, and I think it's something that we really need to kind of think about differently. Anytime you use the term binge watching, which I connotes something negative in general, we use that language descriptively when we're talking about certain mental health conditions, particularly around food consumption. However, or alcohol consumption. However, if we're really looking at what's happening when we're watching a show or a program, We're really attempting to understand ourselves in social experiences. So watching, in particularly a comedy, we're often looking for the good in ourselves, or being able to find through the characters some hope or resolution perhaps for things that are going on in our own experience, or maybe just escape from it.
From a clinical standpoint, is there a definition of what binging is? Like, how much TV is this?
Well, this is certainly not a very clinical use of the term at this point. We're referencing, I think, language now in the popular media that's being applied to television and other forms of consuming entertainment, which has in the past really been applied to eating or consuming of substances. So there isn't really a benchmark right now, a clinical benchmark for what is considered a binging. For me, in kind of in a professional role that I'll serve, is binging maybe anything that is perceived to be excessive or breaks a normal routine that the individual has been able to establish in work and socialization and so forth, and has impeded upon that onto that routine to the point that it's become somehow disruptive. So, in a sense, that individuals using the term binging, it suggests almost implicitly that it's a problem.
Yeah, and so it crosses a line from being something that you perhaps are enjoying taking in to something that may be more compulsive.
Yeah, that's right. And something that maybe a part of you, even as you're enjoying it, is also realizing that this is something that, okay, now this is too much.
So the psychologist also was looking at the Big Bang Theory and referenced that as a program in relation to anxiety.
What's his problem?
His imaginary girlfriend broke up with him.
Been there.
The voice of Sheldon there. And it's hard not to laugh. I mean, can we make that inference there between watching some of these shows and what it can do to our anxiety level?
Sure, certainly. And I feel like having that escape again, and the ability for an individual just kind of maybe tune out for a moment of the stressors and the challenges that we have in our day-to-day life, certainly can have a positive effect. Now imagine any other form of entertainment, going to a play, or having some time stealing 2 hours or so watching a movie. During that time, we can find an individual who's maybe previously stressed out about work and family and everything has now just entered into this terrain of complete escapism. And our brain can somewhat reset how it's functioning in that time period. We're going to find that our blood pressure may go back to normal ranges, and that the things that seem to be preoccupying us at that point in time, and right as we started engaging and watching the program, now kind of just drift away, and it allows us to enter into more open, curious, funny frame of mind, and almost one where we're deciding to be relaxed.
We're talking about binge watching TV, what it does to our health, with clinical psychologist Ben Rader as our guide. When you're binge watching, how closely are you following episodes, or do you put it on in the background while doing something else? Has binge watching impacted your social life, perhaps your relationships, or maybe you've never watched TV shows back to back? Join in with your observations, your questions. Welcome. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Back in just a minute here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about what happens when we binge watch TV. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In the next couple years, Netflix will lose The Office, it'll lose Friends, it'll lose its Disney catalog. And according to Streaming Observer, Netflix users watch about 5 billion hours of content on the streaming service each month. So to break down this binge watching, to watch every episode of Grey's Anatomy, it would take about 14 days. Friends, about 5 days. The Big Bang Theory, 5 days, 19 hours, 30 minutes. It's science, so we can be precise. All of the courtesy there of Binge Clock, and it's a tool that allows you to calculate how much time it'll take you to watch a show. So how does binge watching make you feel? Do you feel less stressed when you do it? Do you feel that you feel good while you're actually watching and then don't feel so good afterward? Join in 800-642-1234. And clinical psychologist Ben Rader is helping us sort through binge watching. He stays with us. So Ben, when is binge watching considered unhealthy? Is there a measurement tool there?
Well, there's not a measurement tool per se now that's being used and applied. I think in my private practice, if somebody's talking about it disrupting the quality of their life or their relationship, somebody's complaining about how much television somebody's watching and they're pulling away from another in a relationship, you know, those are certainly good examples. I usually like to look at the three kind of areas of life in terms of socialization and being social and active out in the world and in work and family. And where does watching television really fit? And is you kind of maybe a binge watching at work certainly can get you into some sort of trouble, or if your whole family time now together is kind of consumed by watching when you would normally be together with the family and connecting with others in your home, that could be problematic. And I believe that any time you're watching things repetitively and for a long period of time, if that's not something that wasn't really scheduled use of your time, if that was somehow a deviation from what normally happens, it can get you into trouble.
Yeah, and so when we sit the toddler down in front of the TV, you know, for hours at a time, maybe not such a great idea there. Let's look at what it can do to sleep. A 2017 study revealed that avid binge watchers can have poor sleep, increased fatigue, insomnia symptoms. Do you see this at all? And what are some symptoms there?
Sure. You know, the circadian rhythm can be impacted by the screen time. And in fact, most sleep hygienists, people who study what it takes to be healthy in sleep, will actually discourage not even having a television in your bedroom or in the space where you're sleeping, just because it can really impact upon your the way that your natural sleep-wake cycle operates. As that, and particularly if you're watching the idea of you're watching television, maybe at a time that your body's should already be asleep, that you're interrupting the normal sleep cycle quite directly because your body should be resting and now it's awake. But even just watching television up until the point of sleep can kind of confuse how your brain's expecting experience the sleep-wake cycle and maybe keep you up a little bit longer than what you would have if you'd maybe turned it off an hour or so beforehand.
Yeah, the CEO of Netflix said a couple years ago, you get a show or a movie you're really dying to watch, he said, and you end up staying up late at night. So he said, we actually compete with sleep and we're winning.
Right. That's quite an admission there.
Yeah. There's a study out of the UK in the journal Scientific Reports suggesting that binge watching TV could slow down our thought process when we get older. And the researchers said some preliminary results indicate TV viewing for more than 3.5 hours a day is related to cognitive decline. What do we know there?
Well, again, we to say we know it, it's a pretty an emerging study. So what do we think is happening? I feel that we're kind of resetting how our brain operates. And if you think of something that you do for 3 hours a day. I mean, what else do we really do 3 hours a day? Think of it in a positive way. Imagine if you exercised for 3 hours a day. We would expect that to have some considerable impact upon our immediate health and wellness. But if you're overdoing it, that also would have a negative impact upon your joints. And we know professional athletes often have difficulties later on in life, physical problems with joints and so forth. So because we can overdo it. So I guess since we're watching television, you think you're really not doing anything at all. But if you're programming 3 hours out of a 24-hour day to be kind of a passive into taking in information in a way that's that isn't all that engaged or active, that certainly could set a pattern of brain function that long-term now has longer-term consequences.
And then there's the food consumption while on the couch and not even really thinking about what you're eating.
Right. And you think about the term consuming, and it really kind of consumption comes with consumption. You know, you're, if you can watch television, oftentimes you're gonna eat or even consume alcohol beverages if you're staying up a little bit later and your body's kind of now out of its normal routine, and people have a habit to want to be doing something while they're watching television. And consumption comes with consumption, and oftentimes people find themselves consuming when they aren't necessarily planning on it. And in fact, a longer history of studies show that watching people consume alcohol or substances on television impacts upon our desire to do that then directly. So any characters that plots that are maybe occurring around a bar or in kind of an area where alcohol consumption is happening, it almost it kind of implicitly suggests that this is something for the consumer watching the program now to kind of engage in also, and it can have an influence on how we'd normally spend that time.
We're talking about binge-watching TV with clinical psychologist Ben Rader. He's a public education coordinator for the Wisconsin Psychological Association. Still time for your thoughts. Do you love watching TV for long periods of time? How many hours a day do you watch? Have you kept track? Do you find shows online or do you use a streaming service? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Ben, as we said earlier, you know, TV is no longer viewed just on a TV set. There are the computers and the tablets and the phones. So it's very accessible. How does the ease of binge watching shows have an impact on us?
Well, I think that's this crucial factor right now. There's a time where and I can still recall where you had to watch a certain program at a certain time, and you were going to wait an entire week.
You had to have a date with that
that's
hour.
Right. That's right. And you had to wait the full week, and then you're going to watch it, you know, maybe again. And there was a time then where people started maybe videotaping or recording their shows and watching it, you know, later on. But even that meant you had to plan to record it and then come back. Now it's literally at your fingertips. And when a series comes out, of course, all episodes are accessible all at once. So the idea that maybe you're left hanging and there's a plot, a loophole or something that's open in the stories, a continuation, and you've just ended one episode, you can now easily move into the next episode in a way that was never possible in the past.
Do you know whether binge watching is a new problem, or is this something that we've been dealing with for a long time now?
Yeah, I think this has been a kind of a disguised problem. It's again nature, human nature 101 somewhat. And that is what we tend to want to continue doing what makes us feel happy and comfortable. And at one point, you may get into that rhythm that you mentioned earlier of now you're feeling more relaxed and you're escaping some degree of anxiety. And the characters that you're kind of watching or following are offering kind of a distraction or maybe even some form of instruction into your own life and circumstances. And it's very reinforcing to be able to just allow yourself to be in that moment. One moment kind of bleeds into the next, and certainly
and
any any escapist activity we have can have that impact on us.
And what about that ability to laugh out loud?
Yeah, that's something, too, that research does show is has some clear benefits. And to be able to – and laughing, too, is something that we tend to do socially. And even when we're alone, you're watching a television program, a laugh track on a show, for instance, kind of suggests you're not alone in your laughter. And you're joining in with the characters. And you're even though you're alone, you're also somehow being social through that laughter. So – it becomes something I think that that helps us feel a little bit more connected to others and to other people's situations.
Ben, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure once again.
Ben Rader is a clinical psychologist in Milwaukee and the public education coordinator for the Wisconsin Psychological Association, and he joined us from our studios in Milwaukee. Coming up, this is the time of year when we see more algae blooms. We'll talk with a lake ecologist about what the blue-green scum is and how we can deal with it. Are there blooms on your lake or pond? Join in, 800-642-1234. We'll talk about toxic blooms after this news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. So how long will the coronavirus last, and will there be a second wave? Two complex questions that everyone wants clarity on. As public health leaders warn the pandemic might not be over, some experts say it's too soon to reopen businesses and resume social activities like going to offices and dining out, even with vigilant social distancing. Others argue that cities must reopen to keep economies alive. So are you concerned about a second wave of COVID-19? What lessons learned from this initial COVID-19 outbreak will help us in future iterations of this disease? We're at 800-642-1234 to join in. Dr. Nasiya Safdar is Medical Director of Infection Control at UW Hospital and Clinics. She's a professor in the Division of Infectious Disease at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Safdar, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, let's start with jargon first. What defines a wave? What constitutes a wave?
You know, there's no official definition of what a wave is, but what it means is that there's a resurgence of cases after an initial decline.
Okay, and so we're seeing that here in Wisconsin. Yesterday, the state reported a new single-day record number of cases with 599 new confirmed. Previous record, 528. So what do you make of these spikes, and is a single day any indication of anything?
I think a single day is too soon to tell, but I think that we were expecting from the public health perspective that once the safer at home expired, that there would be an increase in cases. How high this increase goes and how long it continues for is hard to tell at this point.
So if the World Health Organization says we're right in the middle of the first wave globally, how do you recalibrate that to understand what is happening here in the United States when you have the global outlook?
So I think every country and every region will have its own trajectory of the wave and its own timing of both the first and, if it happens, a second wave. I think what's helpful to look globally is that seasonality in terms of the weather improving doesn't seem to have had much impact on the virus in warmer countries around the world that are experiencing peaks as well. So some things we can learn about the magnitude of it as it moves around the world. But other than that, there's much we don't know about the fall.
Yeah, because the flu ebbs in the summer months. It seems to, not be as prevalent. But then fall and winter, we see those cases come around. Do we have any indication the coronavirus will act in a similar pattern?
There doesn't seem to be enough evidence to support that at the moment. I think one of the things about pandemics is, of course, that somehow the virus has evolved to serve its own purposes. And so if we remember with H1N1, there was a time during the summer when it ebbed a little bit but didn't completely go away, and then it came back with a vengeance in the fall. And so I think we worry that COVID-19 will behave the same way.
as we start to reopen our economies, we open businesses, perhaps schools, daycares, how should Wisconsin and our nation prepare for a second wave of infections?
I think that from the public health perspective, the important things to do will be to recognize that it's not really going to be possible to go back the way we used to do things before COVID-19. So even if we open up things a bit and we go back to doing activities that we had stopped doing for some time, we'll still have to be very vigilant to make sure people are not gathering in large numbers for prolonged periods of time. Easier said than done, but nonetheless, I think businesses and schools and all of those places will need to make plans to accommodate that.
It just reminds me of this line that sticks with me from a public health expert recently, and they put it this way. They said, "Don't unlearn hand washing. You are just getting it right."
Exactly right.
There's something to be said for that. How important is hand washing regardless of daily numbers of infection?
I think the cornerstones of prevention are going to be the same. So respiratory etiquette, not exposing other people to your respiratory emissions, wearing a mask in public, which is something that is very new and alien to most of us. But, you know, so is COVID-19. So desperate times call for unusual measures. And I think we do have to embrace the fact that masking may well become the new normal.
Do we have any indication that we are through our first wave here in Wisconsin? Where are we at?
It seems to be. You know, you only really know when the wave is done is after you've experienced a decline following a peak. So, but it does seem that we had our first wave and now there's little ups and downs in various regions of the state. And then we'll see whether there's a larger, more concerted wave, which really could be just a series of outbreaks strung together in time so that you see this increase that we haven't seen before.
Oh, because if you have little outbreaks, you would then cluster them together and say collectively that is a new wave, a second wave.
Exactly.
So how effective has Wisconsin been with stay at home? The order, of course, lifted, but in flattening the curve, how did we do?
I think that overall, it clearly showed that if you practice rigorous, very severe physical distancing measures, that you can flatten the curve pretty effectively. In the earlier part of the pandemic in Wisconsin, the projections were that the health systems would get overwhelmed due to the numbers of patients that would require care. And, you know, that didn't happen, which is really a success story. Whether it could still happen, I think, is unknown, but we're much better positioned now than we were earlier when we didn't have testing capability, weren't sure about PPE supply chain and all those other things that are so important for the care of patients.
Have you seen those supply chains become firmed up? Do we have the PPE resources positioned in hospitals, for instance?
So I think a lot better than it was. I think the uncertainty about the supply chain remains to some extent because as we experience a second wave, it's possible that others will too, and the demand for PPE may outstrip the supply. But we are certainly in a much better place than we were earlier in the year.
We're talking with Dr. Nasiya Safdar, who is Medical Director of Infection Control at UW Hospital and Clinics. We're looking at the coronavirus through the waves and the ripples, what it all means to our lives. How would you feel about another stay-at-home order if we get another surge or a second wave of infections? Have you been tested for COVID-19? How many of your friends and family have been impacted? What things can we do to stop a second wave? Join in with your questions and what you see going ahead in the next summer months. We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Safdar, how are hospitals like yours preparing for a second wave?
So we are making plans to ensure that we have the three things that are necessary to provide care to both COVID-19 and non-COVID-19 patients. And those things are, do we have the right space? You know, are we able to adequately cohort patients with respiratory illness from those that don't? Do we have the right staffing? A healthy workforce is going to be really important to be able to provide care. And then do we have enough supplies, whether it's testing supplies or whether it's PPE, or whether it's the medications and the critical things that are needed for the care of all patients, whether they have COVID-19 or not.
Let's look at that staffing piece for a moment. How have hospitals protected healthcare workers, the physicians, the nurses, the staff who are in and around these COVID-19 patients? What do you see among the protocols?
So one of the challenges of essential workers is, of course, that physical distancing is hard to maintain. You have to provide the care to sick individuals. So we rely heavily on PPE, and we make sure that our workers are supplied with the right PPE.
Such as masks and the gowns and gloves.
And face shields for eye protection. And that they're given the training that's necessary to make sure that PPE is put on and taken off properly.
How much reuse is going on of these supplies?
Quite a bit of reuse is going on. And, of course, that's concerning because that isn't what we would normally do if we weren't in this crisis. But extended reuse is really what has allowed institutions to prepare that they have enough supplies for what may come, but certainly not an ideal state.
Let's take a call. Jack is joining us from Caledonia this morning. Hi, Jack.
Hi, good morning. I was wondering what the doctor's opinion is on herd immunization and what she feels that the health authorities in Sweden did by just keeping the people that were at risk at home and everybody else maintain their, you know, daily schedule, working, social activities and things.
Jack, thanks.
I think that it's a little bit risky, I think, to take that sort of gamble with a virus that we still don't know enough about, even though we've learned a lot in the last 4 months. It's hard to believe it's only been 4 months since all this began. In general, I think for herd immunity to work, you need to have about 70% of the population or so infected. And that's, of course, a huge number, and we can't really predict what the effect of that illness will be. And I'm not sure that that was something that we would recommend in terms of thinking that that's an answer to the problem.
As you look at the infection rate here in the U.S., leading the world, surpassing 100,000 now, what goes through your mind?
I think that some of the things that contributed to this is really that over time, I think the investment in the public health infrastructure has gone down in this country as a whole. And when you need public health is really when you want to prevent things from happening. Had we had a really robust nationwide public health infrastructure, I wonder if our response could have been a little bit more favorable than what we are learning.
And favorable in what way? Where were we not prepared?
So I think in the ways that we needed to contain the virus. So, you know, it of course varies from regions around this, the country, but public health's capability to do contact tracing, to do testing of those contacts, to even have the PPE to go into people's homes and provide assessment. Those things were happening in some areas, but not as a whole.
We have infectious disease physician Nasia Safdar explaining what a second wave, future presentations of COVID-19 might look like, and the challenges in healthcare. Are you concerned about a new surge? What do you want to know about how social distancing can affect what happens next in this virus outbreak? Do you think we're through our first wave yet? What do you want to know? Join in 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute with Dr. Safdar right here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So generally speaking, a wave in a pandemic is a period of increasing disease transmission following an overall decline. And the longer the pandemic wears on, the more waves are likely to occur. Still time for your questions on ripples, waves, and the timeline here. When do you think the second wave of the coronavirus could hit? Have you been tested for COVID-19? How has it affected your loved ones? What do you want to know about social distancing and how it affects the overall infection numbers? Join in 800-642-1234. Dr. Nasia Safdar stays with us. She's Medical Director of Infection Control at UW Hospitals and Clinics. Well, let's take another call. Pat is with us from Madison. Good morning, Pat.
Hi, good morning. I appreciate the opportunity to ask the doctor this question. It's about PPE. So around town and maybe statewide, There are clinics that have people at the doors in PPE screening for potential COVID positive or people with fevers and so on. So the assumption is that they may encounter people coming into the clinics that could have fevers or answer that they've been in places that they might have contracted the disease. And the whole point is to find out if those people might be entering the clinics. And I wonder why they are only in paper masks and they're not wearing the more protective the N95s, given the assumption that they may encounter the unknown population who have COVID.
So the method of transmission of COVID-19 appears to be via large droplets. And those droplets are emitted by people who are coughing or sneezing or even in some instances talking. The large droplets fall to the ground after emission, which is why the 6 feet rule is so important for physical distancing. And so protection against that kind of transmission is adequately provided by medical grade surgical or procedure masks that have adequate filtration capability for those large droplets. They will not have adequate filtration capability for the small aerosolized things, but those typically happen during procedures where you're manipulating the lungs or the respiratory tract. So the N95 definitely has a place for COVID-19 transmission, but the contact that screeners will have with patients coming in does not warrant that.
And certainly the perception, though, may be different when we see National Guard members who are wearing a lot more protective equipment.
I think that, yes, there is certainly a lot of variation in PPE. The one thing that in infection control we've learned over the years is that you really have to think very carefully about the type of PPE, because it is in the taking it off that people will get contaminated and self-contaminate themselves. So sometimes more PPE is not necessary or always a good idea if it is more than what you need. So it's the matching the PPE to the role, to the risk, and to the job is really important.
When you say taking it off, my mind immediately goes to the risks associated with taking off gloves. Many more people around town are wearing gloves. What would you tell them?
I don't recommend the routine wearing of gloves. I think that all our recommendations from the public health perspective are geared around, you know, how is this virus transmitted? And because it's transmitted through droplets, it's really the face covering and the masking that is likely to give far more protection than gloves.
How does the fact that people can be asymptomatic, not presenting any symptoms, but have the disease, how does that factor into how we treat future patients and a second wave?
Well, I think it poses some unique challenges to containment of the virus. We can, of course, ask people who have symptoms to call into their healthcare provider and to stay at home and so on. But people without symptoms, you know, how do you mitigate that risk? So for health systems, what they're doing is screening all patients coming in for symptoms and then testing those who are getting admitted to catch those who don't have symptoms yet but may develop them in the future, and really asking everyone to wear some kind of PPE while they're in the healthcare system, which is typically a mask and a face shield. Those are all responses to the knowledge that, yes, there can be asymptomatic carriage and transmission.
Let's go to Billy now in Milwaukee. Hi, Billy. What's your question?
Good morning, ladies. I really do want to cooperate with this. And I just sent off for 2 packs of 50 masks that are being sent to me through Amazon. And I was told, don't try to get real medical grade stuff because our first responders need them. I got a basic 3-ply mask. Is that going to be enough?
It's going to be enough if you're not in the healthcare system and don't require medical grade PPE. So even when you look at, you know, different household materials in terms of their effectiveness in preventing transmission, you do get some protection. So for the public, a face covering that they wear and reuse appropriately that can be made of really a wide variety of materials is going to be fine.
And how does that mask protect you or someone else? Can you explain what it actually is doing?
So from the public health perspective outside the healthcare system, if an asymptomatic person, so somebody without symptoms, is wearing a mask, in the event that they are carrying the virus, it will prevent some of that virus from leaving their mouth and nose and entering someone else's mouth and nose. Of course, it's not 100% protection because viruses are very small and they can evade the face covering that people use. But it does give you some protection.
And in the absence of other things that we know will work, this is at least one intervention that we can do. But that's the reason why we say that a face covering is not a substitute for maintaining physical distancing. You really want both.
We're talking with Dr. Nasia Safdar, professor in the Division of Infectious Disease at UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Are you a healthcare employee? What are your coworkers saying about the possibility of a second wave? What have you learned through these few months about COVID-19 and your work as a frontline worker? Join in 800-642-1234. Let's go to Todd now in Madison. Hi, Todd.
Yes, my question is a transmission question. If I'm COVID positive and I go shopping and I pick up a box of cereal and I put it on the conveyor belt at the checkout counter and the person picks it up, is wiping down the conveyor belt after every single transaction do anything at all besides relieve people's anxieties?
Well, so I think it depends. So if there are people who have symptoms that are in these settings, then when you are coughing or sneezing, yes, you are contaminating your environment. And in that case, wiping down surfaces makes sense. For people who don't have symptoms that may be carrying COVID-19, environmental contamination is not likely to be a major route of transmission. But, you know, behavior is hard to switch on and off. So I think getting into the habit of doing more frequent wiping of our environment than we have been used to in the past is a good idea. I do think that it's unnecessary to take it to the nth degree, which is when you see people wearing gloves, wiping down boxes of pasta, for instance. That degree is not necessary for what we know about the virus.
What do we know about the virus outdoors, in the sun, hand railings? Is there any new information there on surfaces that are outdoors?
In general, I think outdoor surfaces are better than indoor. The sun does have an effect on, you know, viruses get desiccated and die out, and so their survival in the environment is less. How much less, we don't know, but that's true for most infections, that sunlight has an unfavorable effect on their survival.
What can we do to help ease and lessen the impact of a second wave? How should we all lead our lives right now?
I think that to the extent possible, having a plan to maintain limited contact with people such that you have a small social network compared to pre-COVID-19, so that if a case were to happen, contact tracing is possible. The reason why these large gatherings are so tricky is because it's virtually impossible to know who's at them and how to even contemplate the idea of contact tracing is just hard to fathom, much less undertake. So I think those are going to be important things for us all to recognize and implement. And then making sure that we really continue to adhere to respiratory etiquette, hand hygiene, get the flu vaccine when it becomes available. And in all cases, if you have a respiratory illness, rather than going out and about, which, you know, people have done before COVID, now is the time to isolate yourself and call in to figure out what the next steps are for getting your self-care.
Dr. Safdar, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Dr. Nasia Safdar, Medical Director of Infection Control at UW Hospital and Clinics. She's a professor in the Division of Infectious Disease at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Just ahead, we talk with a sociologist about how the coronavirus pandemic disproportionately affects low-income families and what resources are there to help people in need now. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.